All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Tim Wendelboe Coffee Podcast. Today, I'm still in Kenya, in Nairobi, at the C. Dorman offices. C. Dorman is a coffee exporter that has been selling coffee to us for many, many years. So I'm here actually for the whole week, it's February now, to select coffees for 2024. And when I'm here, I'm normally greeted by a wonderful person who is normally taking care of all the international buyers. Yuki Young, welcome.
Thank you, pleasure to be here.
Yeah, you are not from Kenya, we can hear on your accent.
No, I'm Australian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So please, maybe you can tell the listeners a little bit about who you are, what you do here, maybe a little bit about your background before you get started into talking about some more interesting topics. So not that you're not interesting, but about Kenyan coffees in general. Yeah.
Yep. So I'm the specialty coffee trader at Dorman's. Dorman's. I have been so for the last 4 years. Dorman's is part of the Ecom group, and I've been with Ecom coming up to 9 years now. So I started with in green coffee, truly with the company in Australia with Condesa, the import branch there. And then I completed internal management trainee program, the Ecom run, by spending some time with an exporter, Capricornio Coffees in Brazil. So I could learn that part of the trade. I also lived and worked from a coffee farm, Fazenda, California.
In Brazil.
Yep. And prior to that, besides a brief internship with another coffee import company, I like to say I grew up in coffee.
Yeah.
So I did, I baristed. I was a barista. I managed cafes. I trained people. I roasted coffee. So I gradually did things step by step. It was always a huge passion for me because I love food, and somehow that transitioned really easily into coffee.
Yeah.
And now I live and work at Origin.
Yeah.
So.
Which is amazing. Yeah. How many years have we been here in Kenya?
4 years.
4 years. Yeah. Okay, and only with Dorman's?
Only with Dorman's.
Yeah.
And I think in coffee, I keep saying over 10 years, but when I really think about it, it's probably closer to 15 at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like me. I started as a barista as well, and then kind of have changed to a roaster, and then now green buyer, and I have my company. But
I actually think it's been hugely valuable to me to have that experience.
Yeah.
Because I can talk to people in a way that maybe some other traders cannot.
Yeah.
I understand what they're trying to do with the product.
Mm.
And if you're, nothing wrong with typical traders, but if you don't have exposure to that, it's much harder to connect with people.
Yeah, it becomes more numbers and not so much the passion that, at least our segment of the industry. I think most coffee people have a lot of passion.
Yeah.
And maybe even traders, they're passionate about numbers, which I'm not so passionate about. All right, so tell me a little bit about what is your work here? Like, for instance, I'm here now, and you've been taking care of me all week, putting coffees on the table. Can you just explain to the listeners a little bit what is it that you actually do as a specialty coffee trader here in Kenya?
I have to share this with my family and friends because I think many people don't really understand what I do either. So I'll start from, let's do a harvest year.
Mm-hmm.
And a harvest year in Kenya actually begins in October, like the 1st of October through to the end of September. Mm. That's coming into the main harvest.
Mm.
By October, we're already looking at who... engaging which buyers might want to come, see how harvest is progressing, maybe take part of specific quality projects. We're traveling up country to visit farms and cooperatives to assess quality, weather, conditions at mills and estates, just to gauge how much volume we could potentially receive as well.
Mm.
Just setting expectations all around.
Mm.
So we're beginning to get busy at that point. There's a lot of movement up and down. We always take a little break during Christmas here. The office is usually shut for a few weeks, yeah. which is fantastic because nice. When by the time we hit January, it's mental. There's yeah. no other way to put it. Really sort of depending on the year where harvest is at, and particularly with these changes in the regulations as well,
yeah.
it's a lot of preparation. So we were not just simply putting coffees out on the table. There's a lot of planning, making sure people who are coming can see the lots that they want to see.
Yeah.
So it's buyers have different strategies as well.
Yeah.
So we might have some buyers who just need to move coffee really quick. Mm. They're buying good quality, but they want it fast as possible. So mm. they're not waiting for the very peak.
Yeah.
So we might prioritize them in the beginning. We have other buyers like yourself who mm. come and you're after something really specific in terms of quality and names. Maybe you're not so concerned about pricing.
Mm.
So then we're shifting you a bit later. It's a little delicate art.
Yeah.
And then all the traders, we all have to work with each other and QC to balance that out.
Yeah.
So imagine for us really in about a two-month period, say 8 to 10 weeks maximum, it's non-stop. Buyers like to come in. I'm sure people have heard of how crazy dormans can get.
Yeah.
We'll have multiple groups in a week, and a group can consist of multiple people as well.
Yeah.
We're cupping auction catalogs. In the past, we were cupping direct. And those have to be done in a certain time frame.
Yeah.
And you're trying to offer people what they've asked for within the price point that they asked for. And after that, you need to move that coffee quickly too. Mm. So it's a lot of pre-planning. You had to be very methodical about things
mm.
and have good attention to detail. So it doesn't just happen. And of course, there's also a lot of communication that we have to have between us, the buyer, and the producer,
mm.
particularly with people for buyers who have a relationship with specific producers or specific cooperatives.
Mm.
For this year, we need, even though we're relying on auction, it's good for us to know, say, for an estate, where did they deliver? When did they deliver? Has the coffee been milled? When can we expect in an auction?
Mm.
Can we get any kind of pre sample before it even hits the catalog? So if a buyer is here, they can see it. The longer we wait, often the things deteriorate,
mm.
Not just in quality, but for price. So you're really trying to maximize value.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a delicate art. It's intense.
It's even for me, like this week, you haven't had a lot of visitors this week, but there has been some. And of course, with the new changes, you're a little bit more limited in terms of what kind of samples you can put on the table for me to taste. And I didn't see some of the names that I kind of want to see. For instance, Karinga, Kagere, coffees that we've been buying in the past. And that's just because they haven't delivered yet to the mills, or it hasn't been milled and it's not put in the auction because you're not in control of the kind of that part anymore. And we explained that a little bit in the previous episode with Kennedy, that I think it's good that maybe you as an exporter don't have more than one hat
yeah.
on your head at the time. But it is challenging now for us as a buyer, because you really have to time when you come. Maybe it's better to come a little bit later after you've been buying some of these coffees, so we can just cup them. But then you have the risk of someone else being there before you who yeah. will buy it. So I guess that's what you're trying to balance in this season.
It's particularly for this season, everything has changed. Like I'm fielding calls of buyers right now who
mm.
in the past you could seek specific weeks, knowing that there's a correlation between our turn week
yeah.
and quality.
Mm.
But this year, that means nothing.
No.
Because that outturn figure, that outturn week number is just the week that the coffee's milled.
Yeah.
So that coffee could have been there for a month.
Yeah.
Maybe more.
Mm.
And that doesn't, it could be fly crop for all you know.
Yeah.
Because some of the mills are very, very backed up.
Yeah. And we have been tasting pretty obvious some coffees that have been standing around for a while this week. Like much more so than maybe before. Like at least I had noticed that there was a lot of coffees that had a little bit of age flavor to them.
Yes, absolutely.
And yeah, it wasn't really correlated with the outer number. So an outer number for the listeners is the week that the cooperative, it used to be the week that the cooperative delivered coffee after the kind of set date of the harvest starts. So in Kenya, you have like week number one in the harvest is 01, and that will be a number on the bag. And then there will be a couple of letters saying which mill it is milled at, and then the number of the actual lot afterwards. So for instance, now I can see in outer numbers like week 20, and normally that would be like coffees from really the peak.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've seen like numbers of 18 with woody flavors already that might be harvested much earlier. So that's a little bit of a challenge, I guess.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, as a coffee bar, you have to really assess the green quality and not look at the numbers. So
yes.
Tasting, look at the moisture, look at the green beans.
Mm-hmm. Water activity.
Yeah.
Visual aspects.
Mm.
Yeah.
So what do you think? I mean, we discussed the system here a little bit, but maybe you can give your opinion on, you know, what makes Kenyan coffee so special. And I will not say anything more than that. You can feel free to answer the way you want.
Everything about Kenya is special. Like for me, also as someone who's worked in a different origin, I loved Brazil.
Mm.
I loved working there. The people are wonderful. It was a stark contrast going from Brazil to come to here.
Mm.
Like Brazil have all the technology, all the resources. They're always, it's so competitive there too, and they're always trying to push the envelope. But it's difficult to produce mind-blowing coffee there.
Mm.
They produce fantastic quality in incredible volume, but it's hard, really hard work, so much work to make a coffee that's 86.
Yeah.
Right? Everything has to be exactly right. And then I came here and I remember cupping my first table. I've never been to Kenya before.
Yeah.
It was for my interview for Dormans and I was here for a few weeks. And I remember laughing as I got halfway down the table because everything there was 86 plus.
Yeah.
Easily.
Yeah.
And it shocked me going out into the field the first time because everything's done in quite a rudimentary way.
Mm.
Like things haven't changed. Things make sense, but it's a bit like, how to put it exactly, if you know the term an old wives' tale, right?
Yeah.
Like it's information that was sort of passed on, and it makes sense because there's an element of truth to it.
Mm.
So people aren't doing the wrong thing. It just hasn't progressed.
Mm.
So I see farmers doing things that, if I compare to Brazil, could potentially be better, but they're sort of stuck in that way because it's a half truth, the information that's been given to them. At one point, it was probably very accurate. That could be how they prune their trees, how they fertilize, how they shade, but it hasn't really changed. But everything else has.
Yeah.
Right. So you have these wonderful farms that the quality is fantastic, but for me, it's mind blowing that the potential for the quality to be excellent is still there.
Mm.
So where could Kenya be if they had access to everything?
Yeah.
You go to a state or washing station here, the pulpers are 50 plus years old.
Yeah.
the techniques are basically the same. If I've gone through quite some books on Kenyan coffee history here, or just the advice that's given, and it hasn't changed. If you look at what CRI recommend now versus what we did here 20, 30 years ago, very little adaptation, very little progress. But the weather has changed so much, especially in the last couple of years. We've had crazy weather. Long rains, like in this harvest, we had long rains and super cold. In past years, had intense drought and heat. But farmers don't change how they do things. So they understand to do small adaptations, but they're not quick enough to catch up. And also something to note is farmers in Kenya are typically much older. It's not a young person who's researching and quick to change. They've retired into coffee. They're in their 60s. Particularly this generation, often they weren't the ones to start farming coffee. So for some, they're also learning as they go. And the information that they have will be like, oh, in April, I'm meant to prune. Or I apply this product at the end of this month. Rather than looking at identifying, okay, I need rain for this product to really be successful.
So they're more fixed on like the traditional, and because they used to be very stable weather patterns. And now it's all changing all the time. They have much more problems with leaf rust, CBD. They have new varieties also, a lot of them. That might need different, have different needs than the traditional SLs.
But they don't. What I mean by that is they absolutely require different methods, but the farmers don't.
They don't adapt.
It's the same thing for everything.
So you're saying, if let's say hypothetically, a wealthy Brazilian farmer came here with all the technology and researchers and set up a farm, you think the coffee would be much better?
I think it has a huge potential to be much better.
And that's crazy, because I mean, we talked a little bit about yesterday during a cupping here, that even though we went through a table where there was nothing really special on the table, still, if you put any of those coffees next to a Brazilian coffee, it would be a 90-point coffee. It's just a different category of coffee, I think. Like, you really, you can't compare a Kenyan coffee to a Brazil, because a high-quality Brazil would be like a really high-quality dark beer, for instance, and a high quality Kenyan coffee would be like a high quality white wine, and there are two different products. You're looking for different things.
The level of complexity that you can get in a good Kenyan coffee, it's, you can't compare that with, it's so unique. And that's something that's been, Kenya's been lucky. It's not to say that farmers here haven't worked hard, but the circumstances in, of which the Kenyan coffee industry has been in, it's like finding this gem that everything just worked for them, just almost by fluke, not quite, but you know, central Kenya, you have the altitude, the elevation, but it's not too cold, so you don't have to worry about frost. You had virgin soils there, so a lot of these farms that we're working with, they've really only planted commercial coffee for, say, since the 1960s, right? So it's been about 60 to 70 years, and they've been really lucky to have varieties like SL 28 and 34, which taste unique. So the combination of those things, perfect volcanic soil, perfect environment and climate, a wonderful distinct variety, you have this product that's super unique. But I think in a way they've had it good for too long, because that means people haven't, they haven't really pushed, they haven't innovated or adapted, because they've become too reliant on getting quality easily.
And also the traditional processing methods they're using was developed very early on, and quite perfected, I have to say. Like, a lot of the processes that I recommend for farmers I buy from in Honduras and in Colombia, it's basically a kind of a hybrid of what we see here in Kenya.
Yeah.
With grading a lot with water, and of course dry fermentation. We try to not ferment for too long, but long enough, and then good washing with grading, soaking, which means you put the washed beans in clean water overnight and then drying on raised beds, maybe in shade. And for me, that's, you know, inspired by Kenya, because
yeah.
the coffees are so clean, so sweet, and uniform. So, but one thing that is interesting, because you said they're lucky with the varieties, but the SL varieties, when planted in other countries, they don't taste the same, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
They do taste fruity, but they're not as intense. So when you talk about climate and everything, I think that's really the combination there is, you don't find it anywhere else in the world. And even if it tastes like SL from Uganda, which is across the border from Mount Elgon.
Well, even Western Kenya, we have SL grown in Western Kenya, and maybe it would just take some adaptation, but I haven't cupped anything from Western Kenya that really matches.
No, it's true.
Central Kenya.
Yeah. It's really weird. We used to buy some coffee from Western Kenya, but that is actually mainly K7 variety.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a very different profile than the Nyeri coffees, for
yeah.
sure.
It's interesting because Mount Elgon there is also very high.
Mm.
Some of these farms are higher up than even in parts of Central.
Mm.
So I don't think it's just altitude.
No.
I mean, you had volcanic soil there too. And the climate's not so different. But I think there is something special about that Central Kenya region where you have Mount Kenya and the Aberdare Range.
Mm.
And it's this perfect subclimate or soil structure there. It just makes it special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe it has something to do with microbes as well. We discussed yesterday, or you were had like a theory why we don't see as many spectacular coffees anymore on the table. And that had something to do with shorter fermentations and a change in how coffee is processed there. Can you explain a little bit about that, your own theory?
So I've been digging through whatever old books I can find
mm.
on coffee production and processing in East Kenya, Eastern Africa. So not just limited to Kenya, but Tanzania, parts of Uganda as well. And they are these coffee production books written by colonial plantation owners. But it is an incredible wealth of information.
Mm.
They were so thorough.
Mm.
And what they wrote then, what they taught then, is essentially what we need to go back to today. It's a bit of a repeat.
Yeah.
So they talk about shade and pruning, different styles of pruning depending on how much shade you have and
mm.
which variety, ground cover, regenerative farming was an aspect of it, because you couldn't easily access chemical inputs like
mm.
you do now. And then fermentation times, which for processing, they identified very early on in East Africa that their product quality wise was far superior to the coffee being sold from Brazil and
mm.
other countries.
Mm.
So they knew that they had a quality product and they had to maintain it. And with processing, it's exactly how what I remember as a younger barista or younger roaster being taught about processing in Kenya, which is this double fermentation style,
yeah.
usually dry first, wet second, and then graded and sometimes soaked, always dried on raised African beds.
Mm.
And then at some point, as I've been here and I've been traveling up country, I realized it wasn't like that. Particularly with cooperatives, fermentation times, if I ask, would be much shorter.
Mm.
Could be maximum a day, often less.
Mm.
And sometimes they weren't doing a secondary fermentation at all. And many, many places don't soak at all. Mm. And I wondered why that was. And I think it's due to the organizations that are coming through Kenya, which you know, we are really focused on sustainability. Well, it's a huge topic, and you have organizations who come through to they have funding to try to help with water usage, conservation, environmental contamination, which was a big thing in wet mill and coffee. And at some point, I think the teaching has been to reduce water usage where possible. And that's just been, okay, well, with fermentation, if the idea is only to remove mucilage, then you don't really need a second step. But, you know, those organizations coming in, they're not looking at cup quality, they're just looking at how can we make the process less wasteful, more efficient. And as you're a board of directors for a cooperative and you hear that and go, oh, well, then we can process coffee faster, it will save us more money, it will save us time. Water can be scarce at times, and we don't need to waste so much water. Because in some places, if they don't have enough water or access to water, they had to buy it.
Yeah.
You had to bring in bowsers. And it's just gradually turned into this, okay, now we're suddenly just fermenting coffee for 12 hours, rather than this 36, 48 hour plus. Because I have been hearing from many buyers that Kenya coffee doesn't quite taste the same.
Yeah.
And when I think of what Kenya coffee was to me, say 5+ years ago, it was big, bold, syrupy, sweet, juicy, lots of dark fruits, citrus. And, well, if I think in color, it's like lots of reds and purples. And now it's turned into this sort of yellow, light green, pinkish kind of profile.
I know what you mean. I think I agree with you a little bit on the processing, because just to explain a little bit to the listeners, when I started coming here, which was around 2009 was the first year I kind of came here to buy coffee. And then I asked how they ferment coffees. They would always say, okay, we get a lot of cherries, so we sort and everything. It's graded with the disc pulper when they use water, the old disc pulpers you talked about, which is like from the 50s. Then the parchment will go to different tanks. And because they didn't necessarily have enough capacity in those tanks, the next day when new cherries came to be depulped, they would take the coffee that had then been fermenting overnight in one tank and move it to another tank further down the hill for a secondary fermentation. And that might be in the morning, so it would ferment for another 24 hours or even longer, depending on the climate. They always said, like, depending on the temperature, it could ferment for up to 72 hours. And then because they didn't have drying capacity, they didn't have enough drying tables, they would put it in a soaking tank, and they could leave the coffee there for up to a week, which is not ideal, but sometimes they did, for them to wait until they had space for drying. And I think you're right that some organizations have been pushing less water usage, but also the volume has come down. Like
that, yes, that's true.
And also, for instance, Karagoto that we buy from, they had built some new soaking tanks, but the engineering of it was so bad, so it was impractical for them to move the coffee there and take it out again. So they stopped using it entirely. And so there, I think there's a lot of these kind of small things that happen over time that just changes the way people do stuff because of logistical challenges, basically. But we also have to face the fact that a lot of the farmers are now changing to hybrid varieties. Ryiru 11. Ryiru has been around for many years, so you can't really blame it on that. But the Batian also has been planted quite a lot. Do you think that also will affect the flavor? Or?
Absolutely. I think what we've seen is gradually, as maybe we didn't notice it straight away also because the percentage of SL was still very high, and then as you dilute that, you begin to taste the difference. Every year we do a blind cupping here from several estates that have big enough segregated plots of variety, so we can taste single variety lots from the same estates. And SL really tastes like SL. Like, there's a very specific cup profile to SL. Same with Ruru, same with Batian. I don't necessarily, like, I think Ruru is quite good. I've also tasted some good Batian, but they're not SL.
No, that's for sure.
Yeah. No, and buyers, the flavor of Kenya is SL coffee.
Yeah.
That's what buyers come from for. Ruru, I think you can get a Ruru coffee that scores 87, 88 plus. But the profile is yellow fruit, floral. It's a bit more delicate. In some respect, probably too similar to coffees from other origins. Whereas SL is so distinct.
Yeah, it is. Red and purple flavors, I think. Yeah, I love using colors as well when I talk about flavor. But I did actually taste just this week three outturns from Karagoto that we have been buying from. Two of them being, you know, the profile that I normally expect to get. And then one that was clearly had a longer fermentation. Maybe they processed it during the weekend and they took a day off, or I don't know. And you can look at the beans that they have been fermented for longer because they're a little bit more pale in color. But it tasted beautiful. And as it cooled, like on the nose in the beginning, I felt like, oh, this is too much ferment. And then as it cools, you start to get this kind of really syrupy flavor of dark berries and everything. That I also remember, like Kenya coffee for me, the first coffee that I was able to describe with a word was Mamuto from George Howell in 2003. He didn't have a coffee shop back then, but he had a restaurant. And he served a Mamuto in a French press. And it was the first time I could actually say a word what I was tasting. I was like, this is blackcurrant. It's like blackcurrant juice. And that's when I kind of discovered how to describe coffee when I cup and everything. I had been working coffee for 5 years then, but mainly working with Monsoon Malabar and not the best coffees. Yeah.
Spice and brown.
So I'm diverging a little bit. But
but like on that, with small estates, what I've noticed is small estates haven't really changed. Many still process with longer fermentation times. And the coffee from good small estates that manage their quality well tastes like old school Kenya.
But there are not many of those estates around.
No. But we cup one today.
That was fantastic.
Yeah, that I think is like, it's an estate that's in Kirinyaga, McKenna Estate. I would love to promote them all because they do a fantastic job. Old SL, it's all old SL, very, very well maintained in the field. And when you taste it, it shows. Like they're doing everything this old school way. The farmer himself, I think, is in his 80s now.
Yeah.
So when you cup that coffee, it just stands out.
Yeah.
It's so juicy and full of black, dark fruits. And
I actually checked my emails because I went to visit that estate it was the year before COVID, so 2019 in November, right before COVID actually. And I was checking my emails because I couldn't find the information that I'd written down about the place. And then I found an email. It was an email to one of the agronomists that worked at the CMS. And this is many years ago. And I said, he had sent me some samples to taste. And I had written back, I really enjoyed the sample, especially the McKenna Estate. That's probably why I wanted to go there. But you're right, we're also buying from a small estate called Kiahia, and although they don't produce a lot of coffee, it's only SL28. And I know that for sure. I went there to see, and the farmer took pride in only growing that. And the coffee has a very different profile than the ones you get from cooperatives that are very nearby. It's much softer and smoother and has this kind of super nice blackcurrant flavor. Even though, like yesterday, we cupped very small screen sizes because the sample was so small we couldn't actually separate the double A's. Still, the coffee is fantastic.
Yeah.
So where do you see Kenyan coffee go in the future? Will there be more SL? Because the fact of the matter is they have to spray a lot of fungicides and stuff to maintain these varieties. What's your take on the future for Kenyan coffee?
I think agronomy in Kenya, the advice has to catch up. I don't think they're wrong, you know, with what they're saying.
Yeah.
We have to work out. we have to work out other methods. Like here, I don't think, well, not that I've seen, at least, many farms practice regenerative agriculture.
Mm.
They're very quick to use chemical inputs because it's easy.
Yeah.
But of course, that makes cost of production obscenely high.
Mm.
We'd like to think Brazil as if it's like, you know, like a mega farm that uses lots of chemicals and things as well, which they do, but Brazil labor is more expensive, inputs are quite expensive, so in the farms that I visited, many will try to offset those costs by working out how they can do things using more natural means,
yeah,
than anything that they had access to, whether that's shade or ground cover, or, you know, focusing on soil quality, structure, water retention.
Mm.
That's missing in Kenya.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've seen when you go up country, many farms, regardless of what size they are, there's often no ground cover at all.
Yeah.
And they'll rather clear that and burn it,
yeah,
instead of trying to maintain soil quality with mulch or something else.
Yeah.
Depending on the area, often I don't think there's enough shade. There's also a fixation on trying to have as much cherry on a tree as possible,
yeah.
Which for me just, it blows my mind, because if you're going to lose half of that to CBD, then what's the point?
Yeah.
Right? You're going to spend all this money to spray it. No guarantee that it will, like, the tree is stressed because it's overproducing, and you're going to lose half of it anyway.
Yeah.
So those, I wonder there with, if hopefully maybe someone like CRI or / CRF, Coffee Research Foundation Institute in Kenya,
yeah,
if they could receive more funding again, or I'd create new best practices in Kenya. Mm. For farmers to be able to focus more on soil quality, maybe reduce their cost of production by using other means, improve their productivity, just by being able to grow, not by planting more coffee, but focusing on harvestable coffee. Yeah, there's still so much room to grow here. I still think there's huge potential in Kenya.
Yeah.
Because we're only halfway there. So.
You know, there's no secret that I'm a fan of regenerative farming, agroforestry, you know, these shades. I see that there could be a quick change in Kenya, because farmers are very interested in the economy of coffee. And if they find something that is more productive or more profitable, less work, any farmer would say, yes, I will change for sure.
Yeah.
But the knowledge is not necessarily here, and the access to that knowledge is, maybe the knowledge is here, but the access to it is not here. So I truly believe, like you're saying, regenerative farming, most of the farmers have very small pieces of land because they have sectioned out the land for their kids and everything. So it's like half a hectare, 1 hectare. And that's just like the perfect setup for permaculture.
Yeah.
I just read an article this morning on my way over here about farm ecology. This biologist talking about the importance of shades. What is the perfect amount of shade? This was from Mexico, so the perfect amount was like 40 to 60%. That made actually the trees produce more cherries than if you didn't have shades. So most farmers believe that, you know, if you have coffee in full sun, you will have much more production. But as you say, you lose a lot of cherries. And it turns out if you have a little bit more shade, you actually gain more yield per tree. If you have too much shade, the yield goes down again. But then you have much less problems with pests and disease because you have more biodiversity, and so on. So there's so many benefits. You have less need for inputs. You could make your own compost. So my dream is that every single farmer in Kenya would go regenerative, of course, because that goes without saying, and did permaculture, because they very often have such small pieces of land that even if they produce, you know, more than average amount of coffee per tree, it's still not enough income to sustain a whole year of life.
Yeah.
So they should produce, you know, food for themselves that they could also sell. Could be like avocado, you see macadamia here. It could be mangoes, whatever that suits their climate. They need trees, they need shrubs, they need, you know, ground cover, as you say. They could grow sweet potato, beans, and really make it a much more profitable farm in total, not just with coffee, but in general, and more productive and less. When you do that kind of systems, you also have much less needs for farm inputs such as mineral fertilizer. So that's my dream, and we do see some of these changes happening already in India, because it's much easier to do on a small farm than a large farm.
Yeah.
You just need to learn how to do it, and someone needs to go in front and do that, I think, and that's probably the challenge here.
Yes. Yeah, not everyone has the resources.
No.
Or the interest.
Yeah,
that's it's you, people have retired into coffee, they're just happy to make.
Yeah, and yeah, I guess
just to get by,
if I was 65 years old and was growing some coffee, you know, I probably wouldn't have the energy to change the ways I do things, you know, because it takes time, you know. Just to grow a shade tree might take 5 to 10 years.
Yes.
And by that time, you are definitely retired. So what's your kind of vision for the next years? I know you have some, maybe you don't want to share it, but you're getting more and more into farming, aren't you?
Oh, yep. I think it's time I can speak about it openly. I'm leaving Dorman's in about a month's time from us recording this podcast, and shifting into managing several coffee estates, starting with one to begin with out towards Thika. One of my frustrations working in my role is hearing what people want, as in what buyers want, and not being able to have access to that product, and with no real fault to anyone, just, you know, with some of these farms, like we've said, it's hard to find passion and interest. Like, you can't force someone to do something that they don't want to do. Also, it's not my farm. It's not a buyer's farm. Who finances these projects? Where do you get the resources? Where do you get the information? Who's going to pay for an agronomist to come? Who will import the new materials or update infrastructure? Who's responsible for that? I can't dump that on a small farm or even a cooperative to do those things. It's super expensive. It's takes a lot of time and focus to do something like that. So when I had this opportunity offered to me, I knew I couldn't say no. Like, I'm being very lucky to have been able to be in almost, well, I have worked on a farm across pretty much the whole supply chain in coffee, particularly specialty coffee. And this was my opportunity to test my theories. So we have a pilot estate that we're starting these projects on, and I would like to do pretty much everything I've discussed. I see the potential in Kenya. I'm very lucky that I have the access to resources and knowledge and technology, and hopefully we can do that bit by bit and see if it's possible, if I'm right that quality, it's untapped. Where can we go? If I can consistently produce 90 point coffee from here, just from SL in Kenya, then
I'm 100% sure you will succeed. I'll have to come back in the coming years to talk about that with you, to see how it goes.
Yeah.
But so you're basically kind of managing a private estate.
Yes.
That is much larger.
Yes.
Where they have planted varieties in different blocks, and so it's more as kind of a systemized.
But it allows for me, it's really exciting because it allows me to, you know, we have plots of only SL28, only 34, Riru, everything else, and I can test all those things and have complete control over it.
Mm.
Hopefully find a great team, particularly of Kenyans who have interest in this, and just expose them to something different.
Yeah.
Hoping to bring in talent from abroad, agronomists and other consultants, not just from one place, but from several different places. I fully understand that you can't take a technique from somewhere else and just apply it here and expect it to work.
Yeah, have to adapt it to your environment.
So I wanted to have an exchange of information to work with agronomists locally as well, and figure out what really is best practice for Kenya. Mm. What can we do that makes makes sense? Mm. And a lot of other sustainability projects that I think have been a long time coming. I think a lot of places, it's hard to even achieve the bare minimum, but I would really like to be a place that exceeds it at all times. So, you know, have you ever seen anywhere here that actually does water recycling and recirculation and treatment well?
No.
Exactly, and it's that would be one of my primary targets in my first year, is just to at least try to do something there.
Yeah.
It just hasn't been a focus here because often we have quite good access to water.
Yeah.
The last couple of years, Kenya has been in severe drought. Mm. We've seen we can't be like that anymore. And it's also not great for the environment to have this highly acidic fermentation water just sitting in pits and slowly seeping back into the ground. It stunned me that I've been to so many estates here of all sizes, all these cooperatives, probably over 100 at this point, maybe closer to 200, and I've never seen any water treatment like this. Like,
that's crazy.
Filtration or separation, settlement tanks.
Not even like treatment with microbes, because that exists a lot in Central America. They have these tanks where they have microbes that kind of treat the water.
Mm, no, not that I've seen.
No.
Maybe it does exist out there somewhere, but I haven't seen it.
Mm.
So, yeah.
No, I've only seen pits in Kenya where they like dig big holes and they let the water rest there and stink up the whole neighborhood.
And then there's a wooden sign with wastewater treatment area placed there, but there's no actual treatment happening.
Well, that's I guess that's how you did sewer in the old days. You just like left it somewhere.
Yeah. Pretended it didn't exist.
Well, I have one last question for you, because this is going on and I know you're busy, but you're talking about estates in Kenya, and there are some quite large estates here and some medium-sized and some small. But why is it that still most buyers that I meet have the impression that the best coffees are still coming from the cooperatives?
Oh, I have an easy answer for that.
Yeah.
Just another observation. Like, you would think that estates would produce better quality because they have more control over things. Often they have, in some ways, better attention to detail to some things. And you often get more sell out of estates. I think one of the easy answers is simply just due to cooperatives picking far better.
Mm.
If you have a cooperative might have several washing stations.
Mm.
Those washing stations can have upwards of 1,000 farmers supplying that washing station. And some of those farms can be as little as a quarter acre.
Mm.
And you'll only pick ripe cherry as you need to and deliver that day by day. It could be 100 kilos. I've seen people deliver as little as 200 grams.
Yeah.
But you keep adding it on.
Yeah.
But because at washing stations they're stricter and you can take the time to do that, picking is so much better. It's far more consistent and the separation is better versus any kind of size of estate where you're paying laborers by the bucket or by the day or the hour or however they've set it up. There's no real incentive. I've rarely been to a place that pays an additional bonus for people to pick well. There'll definitely be a little bit of oversight and some supervision and training. Oh, you're meant to only pick red. But
which never happens.
Which, of course, doesn't happen when you're trying to maximize. Okay, we've only got the laborers in for 3 days this week because I don't want to pay for the full week and they need to go work on my neighbor's farm too. Or they could also be coffee farmers themselves from much smaller, like their own, it could be a smallholder, so they have to look after their own farm too. They're just going to pick. And if I can show photos side by side of estate picking versus cooperative picking.
Mm.
Very different. Yeah.
I have the same impression. This is normally the answer I give when people ask me this. Why don't you buy from big estates in Kenya? Because we could have a direct relationship and do all these things. And I think the problem is like that you're so relying on labor that are just seasonal workers who come in to do picking, you know. They don't, like you said, they don't have any incentive to pick ripe. Of course you could pay them more, but still it's difficult. We find that that's the most difficult thing to change when we work with farmers in Colombia and also other countries, is that the picking is by far the most difficult step to do right in the coffee processing chain. Everything else you can just train a person to do while processing and drying, it's easy, but the picking, you have to train a lot of people. And even if you want to just pick red ripe cherries, sometimes you pick it and you turn it around and it's green on the other side.
It's a shitty job too.
Yeah,
like that's the reality of it. I think people romanticize it, but it sucks.
Yeah, it is.
It's hard work. You in pretty intense conditions, like you have insects, it can be in the sun. Long days doing it too, like everywhere in the world besides maybe Brazil, because you're mechanically harvesting coffee. The reality of it is not nice.
No, that's
so
true.
I can understand if someone paid you to pick coffee for a large estate, you just want to do it, get through it as fast as possible, make the money that you need and hurry up and move on to your next thing. For people to pick well, you really have to incentivize them.
Yeah.
Whether that's a bonus or extra training, or maybe you have a specialized team that pick coffees for your high quality projects, your micro lot projects, and another team that goes in and does the stripping or other quality. Or I think the broader coffee industry has to come to terms with the fact that I think we will have to mechanize one day. It's because it sucks to harvest coffee. It sucks to farm coffee, really. It's so labor intensive. Like the fact that we're dealing with a product that how many hands have to touch? How do we make it better for people? Like you don't want to put people out of work. That is true. But almost everywhere in the world, finding laborers for coffee is getting harder.
It is, for sure.
You know, like if you think
everyone I buy from talk about the same.
Think of somewhere like Kenya, where the literacy and education, which is fantastic, over the last couple of decades has improved greatly. How do you expect those people to want to work on a coffee farm when they can, like where we are in Nairobi right now, we're about an hour outside of the city. So this used to all be coffee farmlands. Now we have warehouses and other commercial businesses here. If you can read and you've had an education, of course, even for me, I would have picked working in an office. It's comfortable.
Yeah.
I get a salary at the end of the month.
Air
conditioning in some cases, or we've got a cafeteria here. Yeah. It's a nicer environment. So we can't continue to romanticize things. It's at some point. I also think technology might catch up.
I think so too. Like, we do see color sorters coming that, you know, 10 years ago they would be like maybe two in the entire world existing for cherry.
Mm-hmm.
And now there are plenty of farms who have that already, and they're becoming cheaper, better.
Yeah.
But I agree with you, like, picking is definitely difficult. And of course it's more motivating knowing from my own farm, when I have a small plot of 100 trees, I can easily pick that alone in one day.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite motivating, because you kind of see you're finishing the work. But if my farm had 10,000 trees, that's
mm-hmm.
a little bit less motivating, because you don't really see the end of it, you know. So I think that's a challenge. And like you say, like, here we're so close to Nairobi. Most coffee in Kenya is very close to Nairobi in general, I would say. Like, in special central Kenya, it's
2 to 3. Now it's like 2 hours.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're a young person, fresh education, of course you're not gonna stay on the farm picking coffee.
But also, their families, they don't want them to work on the farm.
Mm.
They want them to get a good job in the city.
Yeah.
Just like anywhere else in the world.
Yeah. So is there a future for Kenyan coffee, or will it disappear entirely?
It won't if we do the right things. We have to encourage people to stay in coffee,
mm.
and young people to enter coffee, which we do see a bit of. We have to reward people for doing well, for producing high quality. We have to continue to reward people for that.
Mm.
You know, I'm sure for us, it's a bit of an echo chamber. We speak a lot about prices, even though now they seem high.
It's not. No.
You know,
that's true.
When else are you? In what other product can you enjoy the best of something and pay so little?
Yeah. And just as a comparison, I just saw the Best of Panama prize last year. I think the first place got like $10,000 per kilo.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a great coffee, probably. It's a geisha I washed. But why couldn't you, like, here the best coffees
yeah.
go for like $5 or $10
yeah,
per kilo.
That's what's been a huge frustration here, is Kenya definitely has a ceiling price.
Yeah.
Like, it on average, it is one of the most, if not the most expensive origin
mm.
in terms of price per pound or price per kilo paid. But if we have a coffee that's 88, 90 points,
mm.
there's a ceiling.
Mm.
You know, it's very difficult to find coffees here that people are willing to pay, say, even $50 a pound
mm.
Or $50 a kilo for. Whereas in Central America, Central and South America, there's many opportunities to do that.
Yeah.
And why do we have that ceiling? Because if I put those coffees next to each other, let's say I get from an estate somewhere in Guatemala or a product in Brazil or even some coffees from Panama.
Yeah.
If I put a Kenyan next to it, one that's pricing maybe $10 a pound,
yeah.
they're comparable.
Yeah,
if
for
not,
sure.
If not better.
Yeah,
but,
for sure.
But my maximum is 10, and I know that some of those coffees are $30, $50, maybe even $100.
Mm.
So, yeah, we've got to break that ceiling somehow.
And I think this will happen because if the development continues as it has been now, there will be less and less availability of the very best coffees from Kenya, and the amount of buyers will still be here, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen in the auction this week,
yeah,
you know, there's not enough going around right now, so prices are through the roof,
mm.
which is fantastic for farmers.
Yeah, I still think they're too cheap, to be honest, and I think in general coffee is too cheap. If you look at the seed price, it has been on the standstill for 50 years.
Yep.
I remember I listened to a podcast with Erna Knudsen, the kind
oh,
of
yes.
founder of specialty coffee, or who coined the term specialty coffee, which I don't prefer to use myself. But and she was talking about back in the days, they were paying great prices for coffee, she said. And they were paying like $4 and $5 per pound for, you know, coffee from Indonesia and stuff like that.
Wow.
And that was, you know, in the 80s or something.
Yeah.
And today, if you look at the specialty coffee transaction guide, the average price today is like $3.70.
Yeah.
How can that be?
Yeah.
You know?
I know people argue about, oh, the economy is not good, people aren't willing to pay.
Mm.
But
it's still a very cheap luxury, I think.
If people can afford to spend money on, I always like to use beer as an example,
mm.
a product that, is, in my opinion, is much easier to produce.
Mm.
Less labor intensive, most people have no issue going out and dropping $5 on a shitty beer.
Mm.
And often you go somewhere now, a good beer will, a standard glass of beer anywhere, you're paying $10, $15 in some cases.
Mm.
But woe to you who tries to charge $5 for a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
You know, it's incredible how... Why do people get so angry about it?
I just had an SMS from a friend yesterday. He paid 105 Danish, so that's like $10 for a cup of coffee. And he was furious. And I asked him, was the coffee good? He hasn't replied yet.
I know in some cases I've treated myself to just 30 mils of a wonderful whiskey.
Yeah.
Which, yes, it's fantastic, but really it's just sat in a barrel for 30 years. And
you're basically paying rent.
Yeah. Versus, you know, a cup of coffee that so much dedication and passion and labor. Why do people get so angry about that?
Yeah, it's strange.
It's, you shouldn't get upset by it. Someone's worked so hard for that and they deserve to be rewarded.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how to change that mentality. I even my own friends who don't work in coffee, they, you know, if you send them out to the supermarket, most people will reach for the cheapest thing, unfortunately. Even though, you know, they live here and they're exposed to it too. There's a lot of cultural change, I guess, that has to come around.
You know, in time, I think we will get there, but it's going to take a long time.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And some of these things that we're doing right now, like talking about it, will make people understand that, you know, a cup of coffee there is a lot of labor behind. And just by talking with Kennedy, we went through the kind of chain and, you know, how many steps the coffee has to go through before it even comes to the auction.
Yeah. For me to just present someone like yourself coffee, even in one day, I've cupped 300.
Mm.
300 coffees for me to go, okay, maybe 10 of these are worthy for Tim to look at.
Yeah.
And maybe these other 10s for another buyer here or there.
Yeah.
And that's just me cupping, let alone...
And your whole team who's working, roasting.
Yeah.
How many people do you have
sorting
in the cupping lab?
Every sample has to be sorted by hand.
Yeah.
All the physical specs taken. And that's just within our segment, let alone the people before and the people after.
Mm.
And people are only willing to pay $5 a cup. It's... Come on.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, let's end it on that. I am very passionate about paying more for coffee, and we have made a few episodes about that also in our podcast. I would highlight maybe the one that I talked with Klaus, who is also here this week, and Peter DuPont from the Coffee Collective. That's one of my favorite episodes. So for all the listeners, try to pay more for coffee. That's all I have to say. Thank you, Muki, for joining us for this episode. It's been a blast. It's been a blast to be here. Thank you for your time. I know you're very busy, so I appreciate it. And hopefully I can come back next year to talk to you on the farm.
Please do.
Maybe do some filming as well and show people what you've actually been doing there. I'm going to give you more time than 1 year, but it would be cool to just follow it maybe.
Yeah,
it would
be great to show you the progress.
Yeah.
I hope we can put at least get some of those projects started.
Yeah, I have hopes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.